Well, this is cool and pleasant. We just had a question session in one of the dorms. It was smoking.
I'm going to try to start Moody, and then he'll introduce
Moody. Oh, all right.
Moody is, like, really important.
It gives me great pleasure to present the man who will introduce Senator Muskie to you today. He's a circuit judge in Detroit, former student body president at the University of Michigan, the Wayne County chairman of Citizens for Kennedy in 1960. And he has very close ties to MSU by virtue of being married to a Michigan State University Kyle. I present to you Judge Blair Moody, Jr.
Thank you very much, Harvey. It's great to be back at Michigan State, and I might note that the girls here are as pretty as they were back in 1952. Today, certainly very pleased to have such wonderful weather. Your guest lecturer today is married and the father of five children. He is a graduate of Bates College, where he was incidentally the president of his senior class. He is a law graduate of Cornell University and a member of Phi Beta Kappa. And he went and established a law practice in Waterville, Maine, and he was elected to the Maine House of Representatives in 1947, where he ascended to leadership position in his party and was elected thereafter the governor of Maine in 1954. Then in 1958, the people of the state of Maine, in their wisdom, sent your guest lecturer to the United States Senate as a senator from that great state. And thereafter, as you know, in 1968, he became candidate for Vice President of the United States. At a time when cynicism abounds on campuses of our leading universities, and when hypocrisy in a society is seen clearly by sharp eyes of young citizens who wish to correct ancient and recent wrongs and to do better, from the tumult of a party convention in Chicago in 1968, there arose a calm, reasoned, and courageous voice across the land. It was a voice and a position that made America listen, for it asked the best of us, and it raised our sights to accomplish the tasks before us to make the true American dream a reality for us all. It was a voice of your guest lecturer today, and it is an honor to present the Senator from Maine, Edmund S. Muskie.
Thank you, Blair. It's delightful to be here in a setting and a breeze that's more like my own state than it is the rest of the Michigan State University campus this afternoon. I heard that things were hot on the campuses this year, but the climate here this afternoon is the first that I've experienced. You know, I do have a prepared text. I'm not sure I'm going to use it. I wanted to be sure what this was. The first time I came to Michigan as a politician and as a recently elected candidate was in 1954, the year that Judge Moody's father was a candidate for the United States Senate for re-election in the Democratic primary. Unfortunately, he did not live to see that primary through. And I mention that only to express my deep appreciation, Blair, that you were here to present me this afternoon. Well, Democrat won that year, an experience I haven't had recently. I've enjoyed the last 8 months, first as a candidate for vice president and then as a defeated candidate for vice president. I've not yet made up my mind which is better, to be defeated or to win a campaign for the vice presidency. But I've enjoyed all of this 8 months. One of the things I've enjoyed about it is the very unexpected opportunity it has given me to establish a dialogue with this generation of college students. Prior to last August, I had no reason to believe there would be such a dialogue. I had no reason to believe there could be such a dialogue, especially in the light of my own experience as the parent of 5 children. There was nothing in our relationship to suggest that I could communicate. I had tried for 20 years. And I found it a stimulating experience. I found it a challenging experience. And I found it a reassuring experience. It took me back to my own days as a college student. Oh, the issues have changed, attitudes have changed, the methods used to dramatize convictions and protest are different, more vigorous. And I suppose we speak in somewhat different accents and from different backgrounds. But there are two things that are the same, and that is the fact that the young of the human species are dissatisfied with things as they are. And that, to me, is as healthy in 1969 as it was in 1932. One thing I've learned about these past 8 months is that as we undertake to talk to each other and at each other, that we ought to try as best we can to make sure we're talking about the same thing. One of my favorite campaign stories in this connection was often told in the campaign, but I haven't told it in this vicinity, and you might enjoy it. It's the story of a Texan. I know that makes it suspect from the beginning. It's the story of a Texan who was touring in Maine. And while he was there, he thought he'd like to compare Maine farming to Texas ranching. So he stopped at a little Maine farm on a backwoods road and struck up conversation with a Maine farmer, not an easy thing to do. And he said, "By the way, just how big is your farm?" And the farmer said, "Well, you can see just about all of it from where we stand. It begins down there by the brook and follows the brook to that fence and follows the fence to that line of trees and the line of trees to the road and back again." Well, the Texan said, "That isn't very big, is it?" He said, "You know, back home in Texas, on my ranch, if I were to get in my car at 7 o'clock in the morning and drive all day as fast as my car will go, by sunset I just might reach the other end of my ranch." He said, "What do you think of that?" Well, the farmer said, I had a car like that once myself. Well, to get back to last year, I've been asked often what single impression I've taken out of the year 1968 that is most meaningful to me. There are a lot of things happened in 68. A couple of very courageous and great Americans were killed in 1968. The Democratic Party defeated itself in 1968. Chicago happened in 68. Campus disorders grew in 1968. There's a great deal of skepticism and cynicism sweeping over the land in 1968. All of these and other things are memorable things to remember about an unprecedented and unparalleled year in American history. But I haven't mentioned the one thing that I remember about 1968 that to me has most relevance in terms of today and tomorrow in America. And that one thing I can wrap up in one word: intolerance. And I'm not speaking about intolerance based upon race or color or background or region. I'm talking about intolerance for each other's opinions. Americans weren't listening to one another in 1968. The old weren't listening to the young. The young weren't listening to the old. Blacks weren't listening to whites, and whites weren't listening to blacks. An intolerance of opinion held by others. We practiced vigorously in 1968 the freedom to speak, the freedom to assemble, the freedom to protest and to disagree. We forgot that for those freedoms to be meaningful, someone has to be listening. And that the freedom of speech is meaningless unless others feel an obligation to listen to opinions with which they disagree. It's a strange sort of an experience, it seems to me, in a country which is based upon the assumption that as the level of enlightenment rises in a free society, the level of understanding rises with it. We did our best in 1968 to prove that that was wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I think that what happened in 1968 and in 1967, and which is still happening is in 1969, is an understandable initial reaction to a lot of things that people think are wrong about our policies and about our society and about conditions in our country. And I think that this initial protest, which is noisy, disorderly, disorganized, unruly, and at times violent, will be succeeded by an effective and rational and objective and constructive attempt to correct everything that is wrong. because this is the way it has always happened in my lifetime. And this is the way it has always happened throughout our history. And it is because it has always happened this way that I've been willing to live with, to try to understand all of the disorder and indeed the intolerance. I was a college student beginning in 1932, and I'd like to say or discuss two things that happened in my college years that I think you might be interested in, and that I hope might be useful to you as you consider your times, your generation, and the job that lies ahead of you and the rest of us. We were a college generation conditioned by great problems, two great problems. And our lives ever since have been conditioned by our reaction to those great problems. Our contribution to public policy ever since has been conditioned by that experience, those two experiences. The first, the Depression, which brought tragedy into the lives of Americans of my college generation, which made it difficult for young Americans to go to college, which imposed a great cloud upon our futures, which brought untold hardship and sacrifice to millions upon millions of Americans, that left a stamp upon their lives they never forgot. And the trauma of that experience was so great that students of my generation, responding to the magic leadership of Franklin Roosevelt, vowed that we would ensure that Americans would never again have to undergo that kind of an experience. And so we became economic security conscious. And as we began to move out of that problem and began to feel the great surge of strength that our country had, we began to believe that we could have such a thing as total economic security that would ensure us against ever again having a repetition of that experience of our college years. Then the other experience of the 30s. It stemmed out of something that happened when I was in high school in the late 1920s. Something associated with a citizen of the state of Michigan, the Secretary of State of the United States, Secretary Kellogg, and his counterpart in France, Mr. Briand. They told us in the late 1920s that we could outlaw war. So they drafted a treaty to outlaw war, which was signed by the United States and France and the other great powers, and confirmed by the Senate of the United States. We had outlawed war with a piece of paper signed by the great men of the day. And since that time, we've had more war casualties, more war dead, than in the entire previous history of mankind. But because we thought we had outlawed war, in the late 1930s, the Western democracies, militarily unprepared, permitted Hitler to march. And we had World War II. with all of the tragedy that represented for mankind. And so my generation, college students, became military security conscious. And we vowed that never again would the United States be so unprepared that another Hitler could march. And with the coming of the Cold War after World War II, we became even more military security conscious. And again, we thought we could buy total military security. Well, the policies stemming out of my generation in response to those two experiences are the policies against which your generation rebels. You don't see the economic insecurity threat to which we responded. All you see is the materialism, the preoccupation with things which it has produced. And you don't see the military insecurity which prompted our military policies. All you see is that we haven't bought security, that we haven't bought peace, and that you cannot buy it with arms alone. But you see, it took us 30 years to learn that what we believed was right in our student days could be wrong in the days of our maturity. That may be of some help to you. But secondly, and this is more important insofar as I'm concerned, because I'm not going to live your lives with you. More important, I hope that Americans have learned out of 30 years of this experience that there's only one way to build security for any nation, for mankind. And that is to build it out of what is inside human beings. Every problem we see at home or abroad, every point of friction which is visible anywhere in our own society or around the globe originates in a situation or in circumstances in which human beings are not free to develop what is inside them. And until we recognize that fully, not with words, but meaningfully, and until we respond to that recognition effectively, we are going to continue to be insecure at home and abroad. This story has been told so often throughout the history of mankind. It is a tragedy man never learns. And there is evidence on your campuses today that you haven't learned it either. Because there are those on the campuses who, as they respond to the injustices of society, assume unto themselves the arrogance of infallibility, which has been our downfall in the past 30 years. We weren't right, as I've already demonstrated, in the 30s. And some of you can be wrong in the 60s. Don't be so insensitive to the lessons of the past that 15 years from today you'll be undertaking to answer my 7-year-old son when he complains about the policies for which you're responsible and I'm going to make sure that he knows how to protest. I want you to be right about the future. I want you to be right in developing the policies to meet the problems of the present. I want you to do better than we did. And to do that, not only must you recognize our shortcomings, and we have them, but you must recognize your own shortcomings as well. You know, I have two teenagers. And it took us, I guess, at least 16 years of their lives for us to establish communications. And I think we finally got it figured out. We have mutually agreed that there are three ways to learn: by reading, by listening to advice, and by making mistakes. Parents prefer the first two for their children. Their children prefer the third for themselves. It's always been that way. And out of a sense of overprotection, we like to insulate you from the third course of action for too long. And so I force myself, not easily, I'm no paragon of virtue, not always without an argument, to let them make mistakes. It always amazes me that although they make them, they don't make the ones I fear they're going to. And the ones they do aren't as dreadful as I thought they might be. And they're certainly not as bad as the ones I made. The essence of a democratic society and of a university on a democratic society is the idea of diversity. By diversity, we mean that we encourage every member of these two groups, society as a whole and the university, to think independently, to speak freely, and to dissent without any threat of repression. Now, until we get that instinct for freedom in our bones, in our practices, we're not going to get the maximum results from freedom. And I mean freedom to dissent, not only from members of the faculty, not only from the administration of an institution, but with other students as well. The thing that bothers me most about the campuses is the instinct of students to repress the opinions of other students. You can do it to me. I'm old enough. My time may have come anyway. It certainly did last November 5th. But the instinct to repress, the instinct to suppress, the instinct to limit the rights of others, this is the thing you're fighting against, not for. And unless you fight against it vigorously among yourselves, you can't hope to contain it when you get into society itself. Believe me. Yesterday, I had the privilege of making the commencement address at the University of New Brunswick in New Brunswick, Canada. It's my neighboring province. That's why I went. It's almost as lovely a place as Maine. And they have a liberal government. But being there, I happened to, and for the purpose of that speech, I dug out a quotation from Mackenzie King. And he pointed out that the real threat to a free society is not the emergence of different ideas, but the suppression of ideas. The absence of public opinion is a greater threat than a great fragmentation of public opinion. It's the absence of opinion, the absence of disagreement, that produces bad government and autocratic government. Well, don't forget that lesson. We learned it in the 30s. We've learned it over and over again in our own history, beginning with the alien and sedition laws of the 1790s. There's no such thing as freedom growing out of the repression of others, the ideas of others, whether that repression takes place on the campus or in society as a whole. And that's why I think this whole problem of unrest on the campuses, to me, represents both a threat and a promise. It is a promise, if it is what I think it is, a reflection of the ferment of the young who want to make things right. It is a threat if the young use it as an excuse to suppress others. And so I'm for the universities and the colleges and the campuses to solve this problem for themselves. And in the process, you're going to make it uncomfortable for people who think as I do. Because there's a great reaction in the country, as you know, to violence on the campus. There's a great reaction to what others consider irresponsibility on the campus. And you've got irresponsible people just as we do on the outside. But we've got to live this thing through together. And we can do it if we both subscribe to the same ideals. That is freedom. Freedom of expression, an obligation to listen on the part of everybody. I believe it, and I think you do. If we both persist, I think we're going to see the universities of our country and our society itself emerge stronger than they've ever been before.
Senator Muskie has consented to answer a few of your questions. He has a very busy schedule, but I think we have about 15 minutes for questions. So if you do have a question, Senator Muskie will designate you, and please stand up and shout it out loud and clear.
I think it might be better to get in shirt sleeves. Question on ROTC, whether or not they should have academic credit. As far as I'm concerned, that's a decision that ought to be made on every campus. Let me take you back to what I think was the view of students toward ROTC when I was in college. I did not go to an ROTC school. I went to a co-ed school on which there were no fraternities, incidentally. We really had togetherness. But I remember some of my friends at the University of Maine, for example, which was an ROTC school. Now, the idea of credit, academic credit for ROTC, was regarded then as in the interests of the student who wanted to get an easy course and an easy credit. Much like physical training courses or the other courses that football players used to take back in the 30s. And the idea of departmental status was related to the same thing. Now, if today's students have the view that the academic content of ROTC courses ought to be upgraded before they're given credit or before they're given departmental status, to me, that's a perfectly understandable point of view, and I say God bless you, because I think that's a decision for you to make in the light of your interests. Now, with respect to ROTC on the campus, the thing that concerns me here is that I would just like to see all our military officers coming out of military academies. I believe deeply that civilian control of the military is strengthened to the extent that we can expose future officers to the liberating and humanizing influences of the college campuses. And I think that objective would be further advanced if you can add liberalizing content to their courses. And I think the military ought to learn that. Question: what is my position on ABM? I think deployment ought to be delayed, wholly apart from the question, the technical questions of whether it will work or what security it would give us, is a larger question. Incidentally, on that, someone told me the other day they thought it ought to be named, instead of safeguard, the civil servant, because it won't work and you can't fire it. But I'm more concerned about the larger question. In common with all those who served in World War II, I've now lived through a quarter of a century of the Cold War. And I've seen us pursue military security by an escalation of arms, of weapons development, and of mounting military budgets. And it's a never-ending process unless somebody at some point takes the initiative to push an alternative. There are just two possibilities: the Soviet Union and ourselves. Now, such an initiative may not work, but I think it needs to be taken. And that I think its prospects for success are more likely now, before we take another step toward escalation, than it would be after we take such a step. I just think it's meaningless to think of deploying safeguard and not getting a response or a reaction in terms of escalation by the Soviet Union. I just think that's whistling in the dark. Because when you speak about nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union, as well as we, cannot be oblivious to the full implications of another escalation by the other side, however small. So the only course to take is to delay this step. And it isn't that much of a risk, I'm convinced. question, my reaction to President Nixon's Vietnam proposal. Well, I think the essential elements of his proposal have been part of our policy up to now. Not all of those elements have been as explicitly stated, perhaps, before as he did. And not all of them were put together in a single package and in as detailed a form as he did. So I hope these differences can stimulate movement, especially when combined with his stated interest in considering other proposals going beyond those which he stated. I'm hopeful that the fact that the NLF made a proposal followed by his reflects some indication in Paris on both sides to move. I'm sure we've got to move farther than Mr. Nixon's proposals have. I'm sure he understands that. And the NLF will have to move farther than they have. If I'm right in this assessment, then what's involved is a question of timing our concessions, our willingness to move closer toward the other side. What we're going to end up with, if we end up with a negotiated settlement, is a formula which will involve considerable risk for each side from the point of view of the objectives of each side. Now, I think the faster we move toward that formula, the better off we are. But the actual timing of concessions is a tactic that it's difficult for me to try to second guess the president on, at least in public. Question is, do I agree with Averill Harriman that we ought to relax our military pressure at the same time that we put forth this peace plan? Yes. I think we should have maintained that military posture since last fall. Now, it may be that under pressure from the other side, in given instances, in order to protect our own troops, we may have to respond with military pressure, but I think our military policy ought to match our diplomatic policy, if both are to be credible. Questions, my reaction to the president's new draft proposals and my estimate of the prospects in the Congress. Well, it's always good to have the president come around to positions we took in the campaign. He's done it enough thus far to give me some hope for the future. Now, he's not gone as far as we did in the campaign or as did the Marshall Report upon which our proposal was based, or as has Senator Kennedy. President Nixon didn't get into the question of reform of the draft boards, which I think ought to be done, nor did he get into the question of reform of appeals procedures, which I also endorse. And I suspect that there'll be some considerable debate on the question of educational deferments and exactly what they ought to be, as well as on the question of conscientious objection. But I think that out of it all will emerge, at least I think there's a good chance that out of it all will emerge a reform based upon these elements as to which we are in agreement. Question, who will be president in 1973? Now, what would have been your guess 4 years before last year? I don't know. I don't even know who I would like to see president in 1973. How about myself? Well, I thought I just answered that question. Well, let me respond to that seriously rather than facetiously. I don't really know. Now, if somebody offered me the job tomorrow, I think I'd take it. Because it's the kind of, and I'm saying that, I hasten to add, in this sense, that when you get committed to public life, to political life, I mean, the satisfaction is to become a part of your times to the greatest extent that your abilities make possible. And when that kind of an opportunity comes within reach, or seems within reach, it has its attraction. But then on the other side, to pursue it for 4 years means consuming your life in ways that you can't even appreciate until you come close to it. I'm not sure at this moment whether I want to be so consumed. But I haven't rejected the option yet.
Two more questions.
Would I comment on the Justice Fortas affair? Well, one, I think his decision yesterday was a wise one. Two, I think that out of this will come another reevaluation of the whole problem of conflicts of interest, not only in the court, but in the Congress, and I hope at all levels. Having said this, I'm conscious that it isn't an easy problem to solve in any of those cases. But I think we must do whatever our wisdom can suggest to us to reestablish the confidence of the American people in the integrity of our political system. How about dissent without disruption? Destruction. Well, I think that implicit in what I had to say in my more or less formal presentation, I covered my own reaction to it. I don't believe in destruction or violence as a way of communication. I understand, and it's been often pointed out to me by students in these meetings, that sometimes violence is the only effective way of communication to right or wrong. And there are plenty of historic examples to that effect. There was our own beginning. But I point out in response that those who were involved in the American Revolution undertook, as soon as peace came, to create a peaceful method, an orderly method of change, because they regarded it as preferable to violent change, even though they conceded that philosophically, when a society becomes so unjust that its members can't accept it, that they have the higher philosophical right to destroy it. We have a method of orderly change. My whole life is a convincing demonstration to me that it is effective. The changes I've seen wrought in America in my lifetime under this system convince me that it is right. And I just believe that to destroy the methods of change which we have will be to destroy many of the values which we now have and which we've built up over two centuries, rather than a strengthening of those values. And so I'm against destruction. But when I see destruction or violence, I think my first duty is to assume that it reflects a feeling of injustice, rightly or wrongly, and that that underlying cause ought to be examined and understood. You know, I spoke earlier of listening. Listening means something more than just standing passively with open ears. It means listening with an effort to understand why somebody says what he does, or why he does what he does, or why he believes what he does. Because unless we have the capacity to put ourselves in the shoes of others, we cannot have real understanding. And if we don't have that, we're going to have more destruction. So I'm opposed to destruction, but let's always assume that when it happens, there's a cause we cannot ignore.
That's the last one.
This will have to be the last one, I'm told. I would support a question. There is a bill coming up requiring complete disclosure by members of Congress. I would support it. I have two mutual funds, two houses, and two big mortgages held by banks of which I'm not a director.
Thank you very much.